Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, New York Times foreign correspondent Dexter Filkins. My guest is New York Times foreign correspondent. He doesn't want me to call him war correspondent, but that's what he's been. Dexter Filkins. Filkins has an extraordinary new book, The Forever War, a personal impressionistic tale of his experience covering everything from 9/11 to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and especially Iraq. Dexter Filkins, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
How did you get into journalism?
I sort of backed into it. I was kind of disillusioned by everything else I had tried, and then was kind of amazed to see that I could be paid for just writing what I saw.
And where did that start?
That was in at a weekly newspaper in where I grew up, in Cape Canaveral, Florida.
And you ended up at the LA Times? What?
Yeah, I worked for the Miami Herald before that. Mm-hmm. I'm from Florida. I started actually in Orange County. In the Orange County edition of the LA Times, which is, Orange County, which is just south of Los Angeles, is a very different piece of work.
It kind of prepares you for LA. Fallujah, I think.
And India. You know, I went to India for the LA Times in 1997, after about a year in Orange County. Yeah, it was kind of the other side of the mirror. And that's when I started going to Afghanistan and Pakistan, because they were kind of in my neighborhood.
You then came to the New York Times.
I came in 2000, and I was actually covering the Bronx, not terribly happily, but covering the Bronx when 9/11 happened. So I went down, you know, I went down to Ground Zero that first day. I spent several days down there. And then I was sort of back in the newsroom about a week later or so, and one of my editors walked up to me and said, hey, haven't you been to Afghanistan before? You know, of course I had, because I'd gone there several times in the late 90s when I was working for the LA Times, and so I kind of jumped out of my chair, and before I knew it, I was sort of headed back for the war. You know, that was 7 years ago, but it just seemed, you know, it all kind of flew by very quickly. You know, I went back to Afghanistan for a couple of years, and then just like the U.S. government, I think, kind of diverted a lot of our resources and attention to Iraq when that started. I got diverted as well. I moved to Istanbul in 2002. And then, you know, on the first day of the invasion, I rented a car in Kuwait City, and I drove across the border.
I was in New York same time as 9/11. I remember you reporting very clearly. You essentially got there, and you didn't leave. You didn't go home at night. You essentially stayed
right
down there.
Right. I mean, what happened was, you know, I got in that first night. I got in the first day, and it took a long time. I had to loop around and down to Battery Park, and then I kind of walked up, and I actually, you know, I spent about 3 hours eluding the police because I wanted to get in, and I got in, and I got into the sort of, you know, inner place where the fires were burning, and by 6 o'clock at night, I was standing in One Liberty Plaza, which is just across the street from the World Trade Center in the Brooks Brothers, kind of looking down into the fire. And so it was an incredible place to be, and I felt like, or I knew that if I left, I wouldn't get back in, so I just hunkered down there for a while and just hoped that my cell phone batteries wouldn't give out on me.
You had a portion about 9/11 you wanted to read.
Sure. I came over on a ferry. I'd left my car in the street in Weehawken. Didn't even bother parking it. The police weren't letting anyone onto the ferries that day. They were only taking people off of Manhattan, not into it. After some persuading on my part, a policewoman waved me aboard. If I hadn't known something terrible had happened, I might have guessed, just by the looks on people's faces. The men and women were drawn and silent, and remarkably well-dressed, like they were coming from some formal disaster. Nobody was looking back over their shoulder, even though, by early afternoon, there was much to see. The whole sky. By the time I reached Manhattan, the initial shock had passed. A middle-aged woman sat on a curb in Midtown, sobbing, her black purse with a gold snap sitting next to her. I looked into one of the temporary hospitals that had been set up in a storefront north of Canal Street and saw that it was empty, stretcher after empty stretcher, the volunteers trying to busy themselves, all the empty beds. Only later did it occur to me why. Walking in, watching the flames shoot upward, the first thing I thought was that I was back in the Third World. My countrymen were going to think this was the worst thing that ever happened, the end of civilization. In the Third World, this sort of thing happened every day. Earthquakes, famines, plagues. In Orissa, on the eastern coast of India, after the cyclone, the dead were piled up so high and for so long that the dogs couldn't eat anymore. They just lay about waiting for their appetites to come back, lazily looking at one another. 15,000 dead in that one. 17,000 died in the earthquake in Turkey. In Afghanistan, in the earthquake there, 4,000. This was mass murder, that was clear. It was an act of evil. Though I'd seen that too, the 40,000 dead in Kabul. I don't think I was the only person thinking this, who had the darker perspective. All those street vendors who worked near the World Trade Center, from all those different countries, selling falafel and shawarma. When they heard the planes and watched the towers, they must have thought the same thing I did, that they'd come home. It took me several hours to reach the site, getting around all the police checkpoints. I had to walk over to the East River, then down along FDR Drive, and then I looped down around to the southern end of the island, near Battery Park, and walked in that way. It was nearly dark by the time I got there. I remember how quiet it was those last few blocks walking in, everything covered in the thin white dust, the heart of Wall Street, empty and silent. It was as if all the sound had been pulled into the hole in the ground a little farther up. As I moved in closer, my eyes went to a gray-green thing spread across the puddles and rocks, elongated, unrolled, sitting there, unnoticed. An intestine. It kind of jumped out at me, presented itself. It's amazing how the eyes do that, go right to the human flesh, spot it amid the heaviest camouflage of rubble and dirt and glass, as if it were glowing green in an infrared scope. I saw the same phenomenon later on at a suicide bombing in Tel Aviv, the Orthodox volunteers with their spatulas and bags, frantically running and scooping every bit of flesh, no matter how tiny, to save the various souls. Down here, in what had been an intersection south of the Twin Towers, I stood and looked at the gray-green mass, thought about whose it was, how it got here, whether, for instance, it had come from one of the airline passengers, or from one of the people inside one of the buildings, or even, against the odds, from one of the hijackers. Above me stood one of the airplane landing struts, maybe 30 feet high, snapped off and lying at an angle in the street, looking like the collapsed wing of some enormous bird. The tire was still filled with air.
So you stayed down there for a number of days reporting on the firemen sleeping in clothing stores.
Yes, Brooks Brothers.
And before long, you were on your way to Afghanistan.
You know, I spent about a week or so down at Ground Zero and then came back to the newsroom one day, and my editor walked over and said, you know, hadn't you been to Afghanistan before? And so before long, I was on a plane and heading towards Tajikistan, actually, to get back in.
You essentially were overseas for the next 6 years?
I never planned any of it, but for the next seven, really. Or I went to Afghanistan then, you know, I crossed the border from Tajikistan, watched the initial phase of the war. I came out a lot. I was still living in New York then. Stayed in Afghanistan through late 2001, through much of 2002, and then moved to Istanbul and got ready for the Iraq War. Yeah, and I ended up staying in Baghdad for almost 4 years.
You describe in the book both the extraordinary generosity and hospitality that you encountered in Iraq and in the Arab world and throughout the region, and also, of course, you describe, you know, the brutality, the likes of which is unimaginable, the beheadings, the electric drills being put through people. How do you reconcile the hospitality and the brutality coming out of the same people, essentially?
I don't know. I mean, that's the essential contradiction of the Middle East, I think. I mean, people, you know, you come back to the United States and you kind of hear people say, wave of their hand, you know, well, it's, you know, Islam, it's a violent culture.
Oh, it's the Arabs, yes.
Yeah, it's right. The Arabs. And it's like, well, you know, maybe, but God, they're warm when you're there. They're incredibly friendly. I mean, you come into their house, and you could say this really for just about, you know, anywhere in the Muslim world. Not, you know, outside of the Arab world as well, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the same. I mean, you enter a person's house and you are their king. You know, they will do anything for you.
You describe someone trying to give you, I'm trying to remember the scene, somebody with nothing trying to give you a meal when they had no food themselves.
Yeah, I was in Afghanistan 10 years ago. It was 10 years ago. And in Bamiyan, this was before the Buddhas had the great Buddhist statues had come down. It was an area that was still holding out against the Taliban. They had surrounded the area and had blockaded it, and there was a famine. There was a famine over this large swath of territory. I took a UN plane in and tried to reach some of these families, and I would go in and see their families, and they would be dying, and they would be offering me whatever they had from their last bits of food.
So that central contradiction, how do you reconcile it, or do you try?
I don't know that it can be. I mean, I think I just was back in Iraq after a long time away, and when I left there in 2006, I thought that the social fabric in Iraq had been completely shredded beyond all repair. You know, I thought it was, I mean,
Civil war heading right into the heart of it.
Yeah, and I mean there were, it was a total state of nature there. I mean, it was, you know, there were 40, 50 people a day in Baghdad being kidnapped. You know, they were kidnapping children, you know, dumping their bodies in the street. There were you could go to the morgue in Baghdad any morning and there'd be 100 new bodies drilled with holes, burned with acid, you know, bags over their heads. It just, like, the bottom had fallen out. There was no limits anymore to what people could do to each other. And I thought it was lost. I mean, not like the war in a formal sense, but I mean, I thought the civilization was lost. I just thought it was sort of the triumph of barbarism and evil. And I just was back, and it's much better now. It's not paradise. It's not Switzerland, but they have stepped back. They have stepped back. And it's an interesting thing to see. I mean, just leaving the politics aside, kind of who was right and who was wrong and the surge and all that. It's just a remarkable thing to see the relief on people's faces when you can step into a park. There's a long park outside of the New York Times house called Abu Nawas. You just look at the people walking around, parents with children, women walking alone. It's just a nice thing to see. And so I suppose people everywhere have good and bad inside them. And it's a question of which side wins.
Humanity has returned to some extent.
To some extent.
I mean, aside from the surge, aside from the sun, you know, the awakening, you know, what's your personal view? Is it all of these things? Is it Al-Qaeda essentially being defeated and they were the ones who drove the barbarism, or?
Well, I think there was a lot of that. If you look back now on what was happening there in 2005, 2006, the real nightmare, the nightmare years. At the time, it was unclear. You know, it was such a bloody mess. And there was so much killing going on. It looked like the society itself was kind of disintegrating. And in fact, I think it was. But I think what one of the premises that the Americans had when they did the surge, and I think they were right, I think it turns out they were right, at least to a certain extent, was that the killing and that the civil war was being driven by relatively small groups of people. I mean, you basically had Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, Zarqawi on one side, car bombing Shiite mosques, driving the violence and kind of driving the Shiite majority community into the hands of Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite death squads,
the Mahdi army.
Yeah. And that these guys literally, you know, I remember talking to a military officer about it. You know, to us, kind of living there, I mean, we just lived in a regular neighborhood in Baghdad. It was pretty close to anarchy. I remember the American military had a kind of a slightly different view, which is that they could literally track a kind of tit for tat that was going on between, basically, you know, Al-Qaeda. They would hit a Shiite mosque, they'd kill 120 people, and the next morning the death squads would go into Ghazaliya, you know, a Sunni neighborhood in western Baghdad, and pull out a similar number of, you know, 19-year-old Sunni kids, and, you know, shoot them all in the back of the head. That's what was driving it. And so the premise was, or the goal was, of the surge was to kind of take down these small groups that were driving the violence, put American soldiers in the neighborhoods around the clock, which they had never done before, and that if they did that, they could sort of break this terrible dynamic. And they've done that to a certain extent. Now, they got a lot of breaks along the way. You know, the Sunni awakening was a huge, you know, gift from above. It's a very strange thing, the awakening. And I mean, just in a couple of sentences, the Americans now have 100,000 Sunni gunmen on the American payroll, many of whom were killing Americans 18 months ago. And they're happy,
right,
to tell you that. I mean, I sat across from, you know, from a Sunni guy who said to me, you know, I was a member of Jaish Islami and I was blowing up Humvees and I was happy to do it. I wanted to drive the invaders out. And then Al-Qaeda came along and they wanted more. You know, they wanted us to kill Iraqis. They wanted us to kill Shiites. They wanted us to kill government officials. We didn't want to do that. So they started killing us. So I think what happened was the Sunnis, they're only 15-20% of the population. They kind of looked to their right and they had Al-Qaeda. They looked to their left, they had the Shiite death squads. And I think they looked around and they decided their only friends were the Americans. So overnight, the whole thing was stood on its head. You know, everybody wants to know, what's going to happen? And is the calm that's prevailing there, is it permanent? Well, nobody really knows. I think it's very, very fragile. It's not self-sustaining. Ultimately, is it going to last once the Americans leave? Who knows?